or Radio Catskill.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. We're going to learn about crisis pregnancy centers. They're advertised as pregnancy support clinics and run by pro-life organizations. Those in favor of abortion say they're deceptive and manipulative. Those opposed to abortion say they're just providing support and alternatives. Radio Catskill's Annie Bennett has a full report coming up in the second half of the program. And Philip Pantusa will join me in just a few minutes with the latest local news, including a bear attack in the northern Catskills leaves one man hospitalized and one bear euthanized. And the U.S. Department of Justice seeks to have New York's climate change superfund law declared unconstitutional. But first up, the latest news from Albany, where New York lawmakers say the state should step in to keep COVID-19 vaccines accessible. As WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports, they're responding to new federal restrictions.
New York health officials usually follow the federal CDC, but that agency is now controlled by vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The CDC hasn't issued guidance yet on who should get COVID-19 boosters this fall. State Senator John Liu wants to make sure people can easily get those shots. He introduced a bill that would let state health officials authorize the shots at pharmacies, regardless of the CDC.
Unfortunately, pharmacies have stopped carrying it all throughout the state for the simple reason that the federal CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is no longer doing its job.
Kennedy's spokesperson says the federal guidance is based on rigorous evidence, not, quote, the failed politics of the pandemic. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jimmy. Well, students are back in school this week, and across New York State, they're back without their cell phones. School districts across New York are implementing their cell phone bans. Many of them did it yesterday, the first full day of classes for most students. WAMC's Jesse Taylor has more.
Shenandoah students filed into the high school this morning for the first day of classes. But this year's first day marked a new routine as students in New York must forego cell phones to comply with a new statewide mandate. The mandate, included in this year's state budget, requires school districts to implement a bell-to-bell ban on internet-enabled devices like cell phones, laptops, and tablets for the entire school day. However, the state policy gives districts some leeway on how they decide to implement the mandate. Some districts will ask their students to simply keep cell phones out of sight and away by any means, while others, like Shenandoah Central School District in Clifton Park, are requiring that students store devices in designated containers.
We are excited to have our students back on campus and to hear the buzz of learning that happens when they join us. So it's feeling pretty good this morning.
Cecily Wilson-Turner, the school district's interim superintendent, said she hopes the cell phone policy will not be too big of a change.
We have worked for a long time to ensure our students' engagement and to ensure that they are have the least amount of distractions possible when they're in the classrooms. And so very explicitly, our middle schools last year made a really concerted effort to help our middle school students understand the importance of their cell phones being secured in their lockers at all times so that they were not in classrooms. At the high school, the same expectation was that you do not have your cell phone out in class unless it was used for an instructional purpose.
She says while the middle and high schools have slightly different practices, the importance of keeping devices away during instructional time was emphasized across the district last year. Shenandoah Middle School students must keep their devices in lockers throughout the day, while high school students will be required to put their cell phones in storage containers scattered throughout their teachers' classrooms. While the vast majority of schools across the state are complying with the mandate, the policy has been met with both a positive and negative reception. While supporters of the policy, like Natalie McKay, a member of the New York State United Teachers Board of Directors, say the policy will improve students' social skills. McKay is also a middle school English teacher at Schoharie Central School District, which was one of the first districts in the state to adopt a bell-to-bell ban on cell phones. Schoharie's policy has been in place for a few years.
You'll walk through our cafeteria, and you won't see any students on cell phones. They're talking to one another, they're engaging with one another. I was walking through a couple months ago, and students were playing cards. I mean, it's a completely different way of life. It goes back to when I started teaching in the early 2000s.
Time will tell how parents, students, and school faculty will adapt to the new change. In Albany, I'm Jesse Taylor for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to our partners in the New York Public News Network for all of those statewide stories. Now for the latest regional news, we turn to my regular guest on a Thursday evening local edition, Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, who I spoke to just 2 hours ago. Philip, welcome back to the local edition.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
So let's start with a bear attacked a man up in the northern Catskills, and this man was actually hospitalized after the attack, too.
Yeah, so this happened on Saturday in Caro, up in Greene County. A 63-year-old man was returning home, we believe, and as he came into the entry room where food and garbage were stored, he came upon a black bear. The bear, according to the Department of Environmental Conservation Police, tried to leave and then either scratched or bit the man, who, as you mentioned, was then taken to the hospital. So this was quite alarming to, I think, a lot of readers, because attacks by black bears are quite rare. According to a 2007 report from the DEC, which was the last time they did like a comprehensive study of this, there were only 10 people attacked in New York State between 2007 and 1960. That's a period of 47 years. So, you know, that's one every 4.5, 5 years or so. And only two of those resulted in serious injuries, and only one of them was a fatal injury. Since then, we know of at least two more attacks. A man was injured in Fulton County while defending his dog from a bear in 2015, and a child was injured by a bear in North Castle in 2023. And then, of course, there is there's the one that happened over the weekend. So yeah, definitely a lot of alarm, because while black bear sightings are not that rare, attacks certainly are.
I think the other thing that's shocking about this is when people do encounter bears, they're usually outside of the home, not inside.
Yeah, yeah. So perhaps for that reason, the DEC, this is in a follow-up story that we published today, tracked down the bear and humanely euthanized it, which is their terminology. That is in accordance with a manual called the NY State Black Bear Response Manual that lays out different protocols for what actions to take when a black bear encounters and attacks a person. In most circumstances, police are required to do some level of investigation. The real exception there is if, like, they arrive and the attack is underway, and then obviously they're permitted to kill the bear on the spot. But if the investigation, this is not quoting from the Black Bear Response Manual, if DEC police in their investigation find that the bear involved in this incident could be expected to hurt someone else without provocation, and if the bear can be captured and identified, then the bear should be euthanized, according to the manual.
You know, I'm looking at the DEC's website, dec.ny.gov. They have a section called Be Bear Wise, and they have some at-home bear wise basics. They recommend never feed or approach bears, secure food, garbage, and recycling, remove bird feeders when bears are active, never leave pet food outdoors, clean and store grills and smokers, alert neighbors to bear activity. And I'm not saying that the person who was injured by a bear didn't do any of these things. This is just good reminders for us all. And I'll also just point out there, so many of those tips involve, you know, just watching where there might be food or food residue, because that really seems to be what attracts them.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the case here, too. As I noted, this bear was in an entryway or some sort of room at the sort of perimeter of the house where food and garbage were kept. So I imagine that's probably not the most advisable place to put that, particularly if you live in a forested area where bears are likely to be active.
And the other stories you have tonight, they both, involve the courts, but this first one is pretty high profile because it's basically U.S. justice trying to declare an aspect of environmental law in New York as unconstitutional. This is related to the Climate Change Superfund Act. I was wondering if you could tell us, remind us what that is, and then what is it that U.S. justice is saying?
Yeah, so the Climate Change Superfund Act tasks the State Department of Environmental Conservation with establishing regulations to identify, quote, responsible parties and procedures for collecting payments from fossil fuel companies deemed responsible for pollution in New York. This legislation was signed into law at the end of last year by Governor Kathy Hochul over the objections of a bunch of business, energy, and labor organizations. And it was initially proposed in the state budget last year, but stripped out of that and passed through the state legislature, both chambers, and then again signed into law. These regulations are basically a way, it's basically a state-level carbon tax. It doesn't exactly work like a carbon tax would work, but it's a way of levying financial penalties on fossil fuel companies and other polluters. And it's theoretical at this point, because as I said, the law tasks the state DEC with establishing these regulations, but they have not yet done that because the case or the law has basically been tied up in litigation for a couple of months now. It's also not entirely clear how it would work, given that the law would give the state attorney general's office and the State Department of Taxation and Finance the authority to enforce payment demands. Some of those companies are multinational companies that are not headquartered in the United States, much less New York, and the jurisdiction of the state attorney general's office or the Department of Taxation and Finance might not extend to, Russia or Venezuela. So all of this, again, is theoretical at this point. Nevertheless, the federal government has been trying to stop it. So what happened this week was that the Justice Department has asked a judge to issue what's called a summary judgment in a case that began 4 months ago. They filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Manhattan to basically challenge the constitutionality of this act. And now they're seeking what's called a summary judgment, which is basically like, let's not go through all the litigation. The facts of the matter here are clear. Just go ahead and issue a ruling from the bench.
Can you explain to us a little more detail? Like what is the federal case?
Yeah. So as laid out in this motion for summary judgment, which is filed on behalf of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, just another way in which the EPA is sort of doing different stuff now under the Trump administration than it used to. The counsel to the Justice Department's Environmental and Natural Resources Division, Riley Walters, wrote that New York, quote, cannot use its own law to impose liability on energy companies for alleged harm caused by greenhouse gas emissions originating in other states and nations. And that was echoed in a statement by the acting assistant attorney general, Adam Gustafson. He said, quote, New York has overstepped its authority in trying to impose crippling financial penalties on the world's largest energy providers. And individual states have no authority to regulate nationwide and global greenhouse gas emissions. And really what they're targeting there is a claim made in the law and by the environmental groups that support the law that, you know, regardless of where the pollution emanates from, if it ends up in New York, then it negatively impacts New Yorkers. The environment, there's a coalition of environmental groups that includes Catskill Mountain Keeper, who have also filed a motion to make themselves a party to the case, basically. And they've argued that New Yorkers have suffered, quote, substantial harms from climate change, and that it is expected to cost hundreds of billions of dollars for the state to increase its climate resilience under the current measures in place over the next couple of decades. And, you know, that's something we're already seeing, right? We've seen an increasing number of severe weather events, worsening weather events, and the continued degradation of infrastructure that could sort of prevent the worst of those effects, right? And it's also worth mentioning that parallel to this case, there has been a lot of slashing and gutting of federal resources that are intended to help with environmental management and disaster response as well, most notably FEMA in recent weeks. So that's the argument that both sides are making.
Yeah, we're talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley, and we're talking about the Justice Department essentially seeking to have a judge declare New York's Climate Change Superfund Act unconstitutional. And all of that, what really stands out to me is that one quote there, individual states have no authority to regulate nationwide and global greenhouse gas emissions. Often when we talk about some innovative legislation that New York puts out there, and often with things such as social change or climate change, I'm often talking about that it seems that New York State does that with an eye to set wider precedents. It seems very much the case here, right there in that quote, why the U.S. Department of Justice is looking at this is because they're trying to hold off on that type of precedent being established. Do we know anything, and I know this might not be in the article, I'm just curious, do we know anything about the kind of legal judicial authority of that statement, that individual states have no authority to regulate nationwide and global greenhouse gas emissions? Is anybody talking about how that holds up legally? Is there precedent for that? Is this well understood, or is this just a case they're trying to make?
That's just the case they're trying to make. As you noted, it's not unusual for New York and many other states to pass state laws that are intended to set a precedent, either for other states or maybe eventually for a federal law. And New York, particularly, I think, with its legislation in recent years on climate, has been pretty explicit about that. They call this a shot that will be heard around the world when the law was passed at the end of last year. And, the governor and environmental advocates have talked about much of the climate legislation, going back to the climate Act, that the sort of decarbonization mandate that the state is nowhere near on track to hitting when that passed several years ago, as clearly intended to set a precedent. Now, the legal arguments here, that's really what the courts are going to decide. On the one hand, courts in other jurisdictions have found, like, local plaintiffs in a case can hold companies that aren't subject to that jurisdiction accountable if they can prove, material harm or other damage as a result of those companies' actions. That's the argument that the environmental groups are making in this case, but the environmental groups are actually not part of the legal case at the moment. They're trying to become part of it, but that's a separate motion that the judge is going to have to rule on. The Justice Department, in trying to get a judge to strike down this law by hook or by crook, is making a pretty narrow legal argument. They're not really weighing in on the merits of whether pollution is bad. And if it is bad, who's harmed by it and who's responsible and who can be held accountable? Really what they're saying is that New York as a state is vastly overstepping its jurisdiction in trying to hold companies that are not based in New York and maybe not even based in the United States accountable for, perceived or alleged damages that occur to residents of the state. So that's the argument they're making. It'll be up to the judge to decide whether that holds water.
And if we're charting the progress of whether or not this legislation is truly a shot that's being heard around the world, we know that it's at least been heard as far away as Washington, D.C. So that's where we are with that one. Before we go, Philip, I know you have one more story, and this is also a legal story. This is about a Kingston man, a lawsuit over a false arrest, essentially. Somebody saying they were arrested while innocent and that the police ignored or withheld evidence. Where is this case coming from, and where does it stand?
Yeah, so this is a federal lawsuit that was filed on behalf of a Kingston man named James Boykin, who was charged last year with felony burglary. And he was charged several months after his neighbor's apartment was burglarized. And he ended up being held in jail for 8 days. And he said, as a result of being held in prison, he lost his job and then consequently lost his housing when he wasn't able to pay rent. Now, what he's alleging in this lawsuit is that the police officers who were investigating the burglary ignored a lot of evidence that would have cleared him of any potential wrongdoing, cleared him essentially as a suspect in this burglary. Most notably, I guess, was that the perpetrator was captured by a Ring camera, and that showed a man to be about average height, I guess, the guy who broke into the apartment. Boykin, the man who was eventually arrested, is 6'7" tall and also bears no physical resemblance to the individual shown in the video. The other piece of evidence that seems pretty crucial that they allegedly ignored was that the owner of the apartment that was burglarized did not suspect Boykin as being the perpetrator of the burglary at all, and had told police that. And finally, Boykin had an alibi. I believe he was out of town at the time of the burglary. None of that was included in the arrest warrant that Kingston police sought from a judge about 4 months later. It's worth noting that eventually those charges were dropped against him back in December, about a year to the date after the burglary. So this is the reason I think this is worth noting is this is the second federal lawsuit against Kingston police this summer concerning an alleged sort of false or wrongful arrest. Back in July, a woman and her father filed a lawsuit accusing Kingston police of arresting them without cause in front of the woman's house. She had been sitting in an illegally parked car. An officer allegedly tackled her to the ground and arrested her after she tried to record him with her cell phone. Officers then allegedly threatened to tase the father and then arrested him after he approached and expressed concern. So not too often you get one small upstate police department facing simultaneous federal lawsuits alleging civil rights violations, but here we go.
You can find all of these stories and all the details on them and much more at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Antuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, thanks so much for being here with us.
Got it. Take care.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. When someone in the Catskills is pregnant and unsure of where to turn, the first step they take can make all the difference. But not all pregnancy centers are what they seem. Some are crisis pregnancy centers, and they're in our listening area. Often advertised as pregnancy support clinics, crisis pregnancy centers are run by pro-life organizations. Folks in favor of abortion argue they're deceptive and manipulative. Those opposed to abortion say they're just providing support and alternatives. Radio Catskills' Annie Bennett has more.
Is anybody ready to march for life?
The anti-abortion movement has many faces, some of them obvious, like that clip from the New York March for Life, but others are more conspicuous.
If you're feeling pushed one way or the other as to what choice you make regarding your own pregnancy, that's kind of a red flag.
Crisis pregnancy centers, or CPCs, are spread across the country, including in the Catskills. These are clinics run by pro-life groups designed to discourage people from getting abortions. Felicity Gomer, the director of public communications at Family Planning of South Central New York, explains more.
If they're not, you know, supportive and just providing you accurate information to aid in making that decision rather than pressuring you towards one way or the other, and also if there are, you know, religious undertones or coercive undertones, that's something to be aware of.
The pro-choice movement regards CPCs as despicable practices disguised as legitimate medical clinics. But those who run them say they're just trying to provide an alternative to abortion and offer help for those in crisis.
There's such a misconception that we force people to not have abortions and browbeat them and whatever. And it's so the opposite. If you're truly a Christian, you love everyone. We listen to them and we let them tell their stories. Boils down to the fact it's their choice.
That's Diane Kelly. She is the executive director at the Bravo Pregnancy Support Center. They're one of 1,200 centers by CareNet, a large Christian organization. Angela, the chairperson of the Delaware County Pregnancy Center, said their group has a similar goal.
So our mission is to save lives. Our core value is to believe that everyone, including preborn babies, are important and valuable human beings for whom we deeply care about. We recognize that those experiences, unplanned pregnancy, are facing perhaps the greatest personal crisis in their lives, and they don't have to face it alone. Accordingly, we are committed to serve all those facing such a pregnancy by providing them with loving care, support, environment, and assisting them through their times of need.
But unfortunately, says Gomer, it's not as simple as merely supporting pregnant people through crises.
Because CPCs aren't necessarily real medical providers. They aren't bound by HIPAA or medical ethics, meaning that your personal information may not be as protected as it would be false claims about the effects of abortion or the effects of Plan B pills or anything like that. And if a place won't talk about all of your options, it's not a medical clinic, it's an agenda.
Dr. Elizabeth Solger is a fellow with the Physicians for Reproductive Health and an OBGYN PRA practicing in Rochester, New York. She agrees that misinformation is one harmful tactic that separates CPCs from medical clinics and can create a dangerous environment for pregnancy.
Crisis pregnancy centers, what they're often called, they are anti-abortion counseling centers, essentially. So a lot of times they're run by religious groups, anti-abortion organizations. They pose as pregnancy counseling centers, potentially offering prenatal care, things like that. But they really are meant to dissuade people from potentially ending their pregnancies and giving them, you know, options about their own health care. A person that might make an appointment there would potentially receive very biased counseling. Sometimes they do confirmatory ultrasounds that are not diagnostic or done by licensed medical professionals, and many times give the wrong gestational age to someone, saying that, oh, you're too late to have an abortion, or, you know, you don't have these options, so you have to continue your pregnancy, which a lot of times is totally false. They also don't refer people or provide contraception care, which is something that all doctors are required by law to do. So if you don't personally provide birth control or abortion, you need to tell someone, you know, where they could go to get those services. But crisis pregnancy centers do not do that. They just say, oh no, that's not something that is available to you.
Those who run CPCs say they're not out to deceive anyone, but want to make sure that people know about all their options and have support.
To be honest with you, in today's society, if women really want an abortion, they already know to go to Planned Parenthood. So we have very few that come in that are extremely on the fence. But if they are, we just talk to them about the different things. Like I said, we listen to what their story is, and then, you know, it's their decision to make.
Still, Dr. Solger explains that being able to identify a CPC for what it is crucial when seeking out care, especially since many of the centers don't have licensed medical professionals on staff.
Sometimes it is very hard to tell because of the language that is used, like the images. A lot of times crisis pregnancy centers will offer free pregnancy tests, free STI tests, or free ultrasounds just to confirm a pregnancy. But then from there, they don't give you really accurate counseling information or kind of what to do after that. They don't mention birth control, emergency contraception, or abortion referrals. They might say things like abortion alternatives, or even have like religious language or, you know, things kind of undertones like that. You really want to look for a place that has licensed medical providers. You can even explicitly say, do you provide abortions? Because the crisis pregnancy center might kind of just like skirt around the question, but a real clinic should be honest.
There are estimated to be almost 3,000 CPCs across the country, with almost 400 of them in the Northeast. In Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
Well, that's it for the local edition tonight. Thank you so much for being here with me. We do have more news for you now from The Daily, so stay